de cas, de faire autant de pression et sur ce gouvernement qui se dit, en fait, non, qui se dit, parce qu'il y avait une élection, on l'avait voté et il y avait un mandat constitutionnel à propos de ce gouvernement.
Et monsieur Joseph, juste très brièvement, pourriez-vous nous parler du travail que fait le Bureau des avocats internationaux, un peu ses origines, depuis combien de temps vous existez comme bureau et un peu le travail, les raisons pour lesquelles votre bureau a été fondé?
Et le bureau des avocats, c'est un bureau qui était monté par le gouvernement et après le retour du président Aristide en 1994. Et le bureau est monté, et c'était en 1995. C'est pour aider le système judiciaire à monter des dossiers de droits de l'homme. Et vous savez, durant le coup d'État, il y avait pas mal de violations et flagrantes des droits de l'homme. Et maintenant, c'est pour faire en sorte de poursuivre les auteurs de ces violations. Et dans ce temps-là, nous avons préparé et monté et préparé le dossier de Rabuto. Et nous avons aidé le tribunal et tous les acteurs du tribunal et de Gonaïves, c'est-à-dire le commissaire gouvernement, la police de l'arrestation, la juridiction de l'enquête. Et nous représentons aussi au niveau du tribunal, comme partie civile, les victimes. Et généralement, plus d'un disait que c'était le procès le plus complexe qui est connu à Haïti. Et c'était un procès réussi malgré que la Cour de cassation a balayé nos efforts. Et dans un arrêt et rendu le 25 après le coup d'État 2002-2004 et le 5 mai 2005, et la Cour d'appel a rendu une ordonnance et balayant ou bien détruisant les efforts que le bureau des avocats avait et supporté, avait consenti dans ce procès. Et en quelque sorte, nous avons aidé non seulement les victimes de Raboto, mais nous avons travaillé aussi avec les victimes de Cité Soleil et disons avec les pauvres et ceux qui ne peuvent pas et fréquenter, parce que vous savez, depuis les tribunaux en Haïti, c'est inaccessible. Et quand on n'avait pas d'argent, on nous a appris à avoir les services d'un avocat et voir et le système assez coûteux comme ça. Donc nous travaillons, nous aidons et les gens qui habitaient les zones des quartiers pauvres, surtout les pauvres, et les gens de Cité Soleil, des Gonaïves, des Piat, des gens rebelles et les gens qui ne peuvent pas payer les services d'un avocat.
Monsieur,
Et,
monsieur.
mais en quelque sorte, notre travail a changé en quelque sorte. Après le coup de 2004, et vous savez, il y a pas mal de prisonniers politiques avec le coup d'État supporté par le Canada, les États-Unis et la France. Et on avait arrêté, on a persécuté, il y avait une oppression systématique sur les partisans de la Valace. Et maintenant, le bureau des avocats a représenté pas mal de personnes victimes de cette situation, de cette répression systématique des faits organisés par le gouvernement de facto Boniface Latortue. Et voilà, non seulement nous travaillons avec les victimes, mais nous organisons aussi les organisations de base. Et par exemple, dans le cas des prisonniers politiques, nous organisons les femmes, les amis des prisonniers politiques. Il y avait autant d'organisations qui font ce qu'on appelle un peu d'activisme devant les tribunaux. C'est comme à l'exemple du cas de Raboto, non seulement nous travaillons comme avocats, mais nous avons aussi comme activistes et nous organisons les victimes à s'organiser, à formuler des revendications de justice, etc., etc. Donc c'est en gros, en quelque sorte, le travail et du avocat. À présent, nous faisons beaucoup plus de travaux au niveau des droits civils et politiques. Et à présent, comme vous savez, il y a la famille, les droits sociaux, les droits de l'homme et la deuxième génération, c'est les droits socio-économiques. Et maintenant, nous sommes en train de travailler, par exemple, nous sommes en train de travailler sur une plainte et pour la question des droits au logement, sur la question des droits à l'éducation pour porter et l'État à respecter les droits des civils, non seulement les droits civils, mais les droits socio-économiques.
Monsieur,
Donc,
monsieur, monsieur Joseph. Monsieur Joseph, merci. Pardon, merci beaucoup, beaucoup. Malheureusement, on est à court de temps. On a une autre entrevue qui s'en vient, mais on est vraiment reconnaissant. que vous ayez pris le temps de nous parler. Je sais que c'était difficile pour la connexion, alors je vous remercie de votre patience et je remercie aussi mon Steve, mon co-diffuseur d'avoir pris le temps de faire la connexion. On espère qu'on pourra vous interviewer peut-être plus longuement à un autre moment. Et ici à Montréal, on est très solidaire avec le travail que vous faites, évidemment, et on espère rester en contact avec vous. Et c'était très important de vous avoir sur les ondes ce soir. Merci beaucoup.
Merci, c'est la main de vous remercier et je suis disponible et je suis à votre disposition. Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Ok. Voilà. Merci. Ok, so.
We're gonna dance one of the rhythm of Haiti we took from the Manding community of Balan in the north of Haiti. We're gonna dance Haiti with their rhythm.
5 years ago, February 2004, Haiti's experiment in popular democracy ended when rebels backed by the Canadian forces seized the capital. President Aristide, right down to hundreds of local elected officials, were deposed in the coup, wreaking havoc on the small nation of 9 million people. During the reign of terror, activists and union leaders were assaulted, arrested, and killed. In the following years, food prices have soared out of reach of most Haitians. Natural disasters have stalked the country, and any initiative to cancel the crippling debt facing the country has been held up by the international community. While Haiti has been stiffed for millions promised in foreign development aid, millions of dollars have been poured into the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti, or MINUSTAH. For Haitians, this has meant a 9,000-member foreign police and military force occupying their country. 5 years later, the stirrings of a popular movement are again being felt. You are tuned in to CKUT's special 4-hour broadcast, Haiti Since the Coup, 4 hours of power, 5 years of resistance. Over the course of these 4 hours, you will be hearing from activists, union leaders, progressive politicians, and average Haitians speaking about the struggle for a new Haiti, a struggle for wage reform, education, and against the Structural Adjustment Program, Canada's other untalked of occupation. Stay tuned as we explore Canada's role in Haiti and highlight Haitian resistance.
You are listening again to Radio Resistance. We are here in the studio. We just did a quick break to talk to Mario Joseph, human rights lawyer from Haiti, talking about the situation, his work defending political prisoners, and the origins of the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux, founded as a group, as sort of a legal aid entity to help poor people move through the justice system and get some justice done. We're just going to go back very briefly to Eve Engler and Nick Barry-Shaw with the Canada Haiti Action Network. Gentlemen, does this coup d'etat really, people have talked about American imperialism, does this coup d'etat have a Canadian fingerprint on it? In a couple minutes before we go on to the next interview, what can you say about that?
I would just like to say that the Canadian fingerprint in Haiti is really important, and it really tells us a lot about the direction that our government and our country is going and what kind of role it sees itself playing in the future in the Americas and in the rest of the world, so not just in Haiti. Probably one of the most disturbing things to come out most recently was the admission in a 2006 military document that Canadian troops that landed in Haiti right after the coup d'etat in February 2004 were carrying out counterinsurgency operations on the ground. This consisted of basically going door to door, and in one instance, according to a family from a poor neighborhood in Port-au-Prince, threatening people and saying, you know, if you don't tell us where the Lavalas supporters are, we're going to kill you and your family. And so it revealed that the Canadian troops were there, were not just kind of sitting around by the poolside having mixed drinks, but they were really an active part in the repression that really engulfed the country for 2 years right after the coup.
And perhaps one just last word for you, Eve. We'll certainly discuss this in more detail in the subsequent show, but one last word for our listeners.
Well, I think especially for the direction of Canadian foreign policy, Haiti provides us an indication of the direction. Is this whole concept of responsibility to protect, which is a doctrine that the Canadian government, the Liberal government of Jean Chrétien, was pushing and is pushing at the United Nations and wants actually to the United Nations to adopt this doctrine into international law. And basically what the doctrine says is that when a country is unstable or it's a failed state or there's massive human rights violations, it's the responsibility for the international community to intervene. And that's this doctrine, responsibility to protect, is how the Liberal government justified its intervention into Haiti. And what's the result? The result is every single social indicator in the country has massively deteriorated. You have huge amounts of human rights violations, thousands, according to the Lancet Medical Journal report, that 22 months after the coup, there were 8,000 people killed just in Port-au-Prince, in the capital of Port-au-Prince. 4,000 of those 8,000 people, almost 4,000, were by political actors. The Canadian trained Haitian police, former military, and different gangs that were seen as anti-Lavalas gangs. So this doctrine, the Canadian-sponsored doctrine of responsibility to protect, the case of Haiti shows that this is really just a cover for imperialism.
Okay, and thank you both to both of you very, very much. Obviously, we'll continue to cover the work of the Canada-Haiti Action Network over the next few shows, and obviously there's a lot more to be said on this topic, but thank you very much for joining us. We are going to go in now that we're moving into our last hour with Voices from the Ground. Two Haitian activists will be speaking. First, we'll be having an interview that was a talk that was recorded last year in Montreal by Mr. Lulu Cherie, so a union activist from Haiti. This will be an excerpt from a talk he gave in French talking about the coup and how it affected the union movement and what it means to be a union organizer in Haiti today. And directly after that, or perhaps through a song, but directly after that, we'll be having an interview with Patrick Ely, an activist on the ground that we reached in Port-au-Prince, talking about future perspectives for Haiti and some of Haiti's allies. We've been talking about Haiti's enemies, the NGO class, the political class in Canada, but he's talking about who are Haiti's allies and an interesting answer to that question. So we'll be going into an interview with Lulu Cherie, union activist, and then we'll be talking with Patrick Ely in Port-au-Prince. Stay tuned.
I think we're going to go with Patrick first.
Right? Okay. No problem. Patrick Ely, step right up. Enemies these days, unfortunately, but who are its friends? What are the countries, in your opinion, that have done the most to help Haiti over the last few years?
Well, I'd have to say Cuba. Mm-hmm. For the quality of the cooperation they've offered to Haiti in very crucial matters, most notably health, including in Haiti by sending Cuban doctors, but also by forming Haitian doctors in Haiti, where we've had only one public university for years, mm-hmm. and also in other fields like veterinary medicine, mm-hmm. fishing, fish farming, key issue, and now education, because they are quite active in the literacy campaign that the government of Mr. Preval has, after taking over from the program initiated by President Aristide, has launched a literacy campaign in which the Cuban have been very, very helpful.
Could you just tell us how many Cuban technicians or whatever are there in Haiti right now, and where are they active? Are we talking in Port-au-Prince? Are we talking more generally?
No. I can't pull a number mm-hmm. out of my head, because, you know, I'm not really involved in government, but I can tell you that they're not precisely, you know, they do not stay in Port-au-Prince, and they go even where Haitian professionals won't go, because the conditions are too uncomfortable, and the Cuban doctors in particular have a lot of appreciation from the Haitian population, precisely because they show a willingness to live like the poorest of Haitian and go to the remote part of the country where the lack of health facilities and professional is the most acute.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And has this made a noticeable difference in health indicators in people's lives in the areas where the Cuban doctors are active?
Oh yes, definitely. And they've been very active lately. You know, they produce a number of statistics on the number of operations, consultations, et cetera, that they did. And it's quite impressive, you know, one has to admit that. And they've been doing that sometimes, you know, facing the hostility of the Haitian medical community.
Mm-hmm.
Some member which resents, you know, this type of medicine, which is based more on service than business.
Mm.
They do not treat health as an ordinary merchandise.
I wanted to ask you, Mr. Lee, last year Haiti got hit by a series of very devastating hurricanes, and we know that the Cuban state has a very good system in place for mitigating the effects of hurricanes and getting people out of the way. Was there any way in which the Cuban technicians in Haiti were able to help with that kind of operation this year, or is there plans to help them create a hurricane mitigation program in the future?
I don't know if they have been doing that, but it's one thing that we have recommended, that Haiti learns from Cuba how to develop a strong civil defense system and policy,
mm-hmm.
Because it's true that the Cubans are probably among the best in the world in dealing with natural catastrophes,
mm-hmm.
and we do need to learn from them and to share our experience and concern with them.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, countries like Canada have put a lot of so-called aid projects on the ground in Haiti, and these sometimes include health clinics. Could you maybe compare the Canadian and the Cuban aid and tell us what's different about the Cuban aid approach and perhaps what makes it better in your view?
I believe, you know, that the proposal has been made that countries like Canada, which are a country of the G8 or G7, should, if they want to be really serious and efficient in their aid, should help finance aid program, but that should be executed by people that are living in conditions that are more akin, more close to the condition of Haiti. And these include, of course, the Cubans,
mm-hmm.
but also maybe a couple of other countries of South America or Latin America, if you may.
Mm-hmm.
That would be best. You know, if the aim is truly to help the people of Haiti, rather than possibly, you know, pushing the Canadian agenda or help, you know, repatriate most of the money through acquisition of expensive equipment and paying, you know, very expensive expert from Canada itself.
Mm. Suggesting that Canada should finance programs by which countries like Cuba that have experience in the region could send their technicians to Haiti and work on the ground.
Yes, because, you know, you send one Canadian doctor, for example, down here, first of all, is going to be disoriented because the conditions are so different than the ones in Canada in every which way you look at it. And also, for the same cost, you might have, you know, something like maybe 10 Cuban doctors or technicians of any kind doing the same work. Mm. So, you know, it's just a matter of accounting, if you may.
One last question, Mr. Ali, unless you have something you want to add. Cuba is obviously a country that 50 years ago, at the start of its revolutionary process, faced conditions perhaps similar to those Haiti's facing today. It faced foreign domination, faced obviously underdevelopment of certain sectors of the economy. Do you think that Haiti, by investing in the right social policies, would be able to replicate more generally some of the successes that Cuba's had in creating literacy, reducing infant mortality, and sort of the human development? Do you think Haiti could replicate Cuba's success if it invested in the right policies? And if so, how much time would it take to do so?
Well, you know, it would depend, you know, on the political will of Haitian leaders and their ability to mobilize the population and build up credibility with that population. But certainly, if not replicating the Cuban experience, we should definitely inspire ourselves from it, because it's been a success. You know, no matter from what ideological side of the fence, it is true that the progress in terms of quality of life in 50 years have been enormous, and no other country can claim such success, especially not in our region of the world.
You know. Cette bataille de Verxières, cette bataille de Verxières, je la dédie à tous mes pères, des salines capois, boiront tonnerre. Cette bataille de Verxières, cette bataille de Verxières, je la dédie à tous mes pères, des salines capois, boiront tonnerre. Voilà la mort, un rush en artillerie militaire pour cette bataille de Verxières. On reste un guerrier comme Sonny à l'hiver. Je libère mes confrères emprisonnés dans l'idéologie amère du général Leclerc. Un coup d'éclair, j'aiguise l'épée de Boiron-Tonnerre pour péter les nerfs de système satanique et planté depuis 6 millénaires. L'art de la guerre se cache derrière ma colère. Prospère comme Gabriel Prosper, un révolutionnaire aux méthodes guerrières. Coup de couteau, coup de râteau sur les idéaux de Nicolas Ovando, Colin Diego. Sans jeu à cache-cache comme Carmen San Diego. Bookman des salines, Cola Padre, Jacques Odabo. De la révolution, voyez gros. Ces vrais héros se rester dévoués pour l'éternité. Sur le MIC, ma lutte est engagée. Je dégage un noiriste à la Louis Joseph Janvier. Froid comme le mois de janvier. Toujours équipé pour assassiner les traîtres de façon explicite. Quelques soufflette illicite pour Chamblay, André Appel et Guy Philippe. Battrip le 18 novembre 1803. Le diable s'est mis à pleurer à flot. Regarde la défaite de Donatien Rochambeau. Aujourd'hui je pisse sur son tombeau.
The Haiti solidarity movement in North America these days is that the coup itself is history. We can denounce the coup, but we can't really undo the coup. What can and should Canadian American activists who care about Haiti be asking of their own governments in terms of Haiti policy over the next few months?
Well, I think the double standard policies that North America, especially the American government, have had toward Haiti during the coup, it's mind-boggling. First of all, we know that President Aristide was a duly elected president. He was a constitutional president. Mm-hmm. And according to our constitution, he was elected for 5 years. Mm. Therefore, he was supposed to do his 5 years. But we know the role that Canada and France and the United States have played in the removal of President Aristide, the constitutional president of our country. And since then, the country has been going downfall. It has been problems after problems. We have political turmoil, we have ecological turmoil, we have natural turmoil. And right now I believe that those who have worked to put Haiti in this situation should maybe not undo the coup, but at least to give the population of Haiti a chance to continue to live with dignity.
So from what you're saying, things have been going worse than it was in 2004.
Well, I don't have to say, you don't have to take it from me. Mm-hmm. You just have to go to Haiti. Mm-hmm. As soon as you get off the airport, yeah. you can see very clearly mm-hmm. what's going on in the country, the despair. And our listeners probably have heard also or read about the four hurricanes back-to-back. Back in 2004, mm-hmm. President Aristide was kidnapped in February of 2004, mm-hmm. and in November 2004, they had Hurricane Jane that have killed over 5,000 people yeah. in the town of Gonaïves. Mm-hmm. And then there have been La Tortue, mm-hmm. who was doing what they call la chasse aux sorcières, mm-hmm. towards all the sympathizers and the members of La Valas movement. Mm-hmm. Among one of them, remember Father Gérard Jean-Just, yes. who was put in jail. Yes. So Anne, Prime Minister Yvonne Thun, mm-hmm. Amanis Mayette, I mean, all these people from the La Valas, mm-hmm. they were put in jail, and until today, many of them still remain in jail. Mm-hmm. And although in 2006, President mm-hmm. Préval had come into office, well, not much have changed since then. And we see that the hunger is still there, the despair of the Haitian population mm-hmm. is still very present. I think something needs to be done, otherwise it's going to be, as we would say in French, une bombe à retardement.
Mm-hmm. 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 Uh-huh. Ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
Do you have any hope, Ms. Tondreau, that the new Obama administration and also the Democrat-controlled Congress in the United States, at least, will change their policy towards Haiti in any small way?
Well, I do believe there will be some changes, except that it is so early and we have inherited so many problems in the United States, economically especially. President Obama has so much in his plate right now. I'm not sure Haiti is one of his priorities. Therefore, mm-hmm. it is our duty to remind him. The Obama administration would have a lot to do toward the Caribbean, specifically in Haiti, mm-hmm. knowing the history of Haiti, knowing what Haiti went through with all those coups d'etat. You know what, the elimination of Haiti's debt have been something that we've been fighting for so many years, and all, but of course we knew with the Bush administration wouldn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Therefore, with the vast majority of Democrats in the chambers, although we have to say that some Democrats are more conservative than Republicans, mm-hmm. We certainly hope that they will go forward with the elimination of Haiti's debt, because most of those debts occurred during the reign of Papa Doc and Baby mm-hmm. Doc, and they know that the money was taken by Jean-Claude Duvalier to France mm-hmm. to have a lavish life. And although right now we're trying to recuperate some of them, mm-hmm. we're not sure how much we're going to get from them. Mm-hmm. One of the things is the elimination of the debt of Haiti. And the other thing I remember, there is some money that was allocated to Haiti. The money never got to Haiti. And one of the things, talking about policies, mm-hmm. is that those NGOs in Haiti that is in competition with the government of yeah. Haiti for money, this has to be regulated. It does not make any sense when you have so many NGOs, and we know that so many of them were created back in 2002 and 2003 mm-hmm. in order to oust President Aristide, yeah. in order to put turmoil in this country, and they were getting money so, because they were doing some humanitarian job. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the results in Haiti, there's absolutely nothing going on, and they're in competition with the government with mm-hmm. the money that they're giving there. The money goes straight to them and nothing to the government.
Exactly. I mean, I think we even have an example with the hurricane that happened. I mean, the same hurricane that hit Cuba, and there was not even one dead because they had a plan to evacuate the people. But in Haiti, all these NGOs has been there for all these years, and they didn't even have a plan. And
I think it is a problem.
It's a major problem.
You cannot have any non-governmental organizations mm-hmm. competing with the government, yeah. especially when the government itself cannot regulate those NGOs. There is absolutely no way mm-hmm. for anybody to evaluate the amount of work that they are doing. Mm-hmm. And as you just mentioned, during the hurricane, they had absolutely nothing ready. And mm-hmm. we're talking about déboisement, you know, the problem that we have with the ecological
yeah.
and the wood that they are cutting mm-hmm. in order for them to cook. None of them have come up yet with anything to replace those those trees that have been cut or the way the people are cooking in order for them to stop cutting the trees. So I'm wondering, what is the meaning of giving the NGOs money if that's for them to get new cars, to try to pay people to go and demonstrate and to cause trouble in the country?
One thing people have said to us a lot, they say Haiti, of course, doesn't have oil the way Iraq did. Haiti is a relatively small country with, you know, some natural resources. But what was the motive? Why did Canada, the U.S., and France want to effect regime change in Haiti? What was in it for them?
You see, it is so funny. When I'm hearing people saying that Haiti is a poor country, there's absolutely nothing in Haiti. If there was nothing in Haiti, none of this country would be interested in
exactly.
Haiti. Yeah. We know in Haiti they have mines of gold, and in Haiti we have twice the amount of gold than Canada. And Canada is one of the countries that is recognized as being the number one in gold.
Yeah.
In Haiti we have twice the amount of gold that Canada has. Haiti, we have bauxite. In Haiti, we have copper. In Haiti, we have all those type of things. Each time we are being occupied by one of these countries, there's a scandal. Remember the scandal of Île Vache, when they have found under the sea so many treasures from Haiti and so many gold and diamonds, and they're all in Canada right now. And there is an organization called Sainte-Geneviève.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are doing the gold, and nobody knows exactly what is the deal with the government, how much goes to the Haitian population or Haiti, and how much goes to the company that is exploiting those mines. If the country was that poor, why don't they just leave Haitians alone to solve their own problems?
Exactly.
We wanted to ask you also, as you mentioned, Haiti did have elections in 2006, 2 years after the coup. Haiti now has an elected president, but the UN forces still remain on Haitian soil. In these circumstances, is Haiti a free country? Can it choose its own destiny today?
Well, Haiti is under occupation, we have to say it, but some type of rough occupation that is not there to build. Of course, we know that none of the countries that have ever been occupied, they have never done anything positive with them besides breaking everything apart. Haiti is pretty much in the same way. The UN, we call them tourista. They are like tourism in Haiti for what they are doing. And we know that during the terror of La Tortue, during those 2 years after the coup d'etat in Haiti, what the UN have done specifically in Cité Soleil, killing our youth, killing babies and calling them thugs. And right now, the fact that they are raping the children. Remember the soldiers from Sri Lanka?
They have raped
so many young Haitian. We're talking about kids from 2 years old to 16 years old have been raped, and all they did was to return them back home with any accountability, any repairs being done, any justice being done for the Haitian population. And it's pretty much the same in killing the people also of Haiti. Absolutely nothing is being done. No one is accountable. And of course, they're always the first one to say that everybody, it seems like this is a country of thugs, because whenever they want to justify the massacre that they've done in Haiti, they're calling our people thugs.
Yeah, they call them chimères and stuff like that.
So which means, since they are chimères, it's okay to kill them.
Yeah, to kill them.
And we know in a country like the United States, Canada, and France, when justice must prevail, they know that people have due process.
Exactly.
You cannot be guilty before being proven that you are guilty.
What are the biggest challenges facing Haitians in 2009?
Well, the challenges right now, the big one right now, it's really to put democracy back in its rail in Haiti and try to put food on the table to create jobs in Haiti and infrastructure in order for tourists to start coming in the country. We have a beautiful country. We have so much to offer as a first black republic to have its independence. Haiti has so much to offer if only we had some structure in this country. But most of all, it's the outcry of human violations. Now, democracy violation, have you heard? I'm sure you have heard for the past week or so, the new electoral council have decided to prevent anyone from the Lavalas party to participate in the upcoming elections. And this is this is just not right. Again, this is a violation of the basic rights of any political party to be in this country, and their viability also. Since you have a democratic election with by removing the biggest and the strongest party in this country,
do you think that with everything that happened with the coup, we've seen, like you even said from the beginning, and like a lot of reports show, things have been going worse. Do you think that we could have a change of attitude coming from the elite that usually always sides with the intruders? Do you think that the elite might change their attitude now?
Well, I think they've learned a great deal mm-hmm. from their mistake, because a lot of them mm-hmm. were shocked mm-hmm. when they heard that La Tortue was going to be the one replacing Aristide, because La Tortue is not well respected or well liked mm-hmm. among them either.
Okay.
A lot of them regret mm-hmm. having participating in the coup d'etat that sent President Aristide out of power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we need really, it's not the elite, it's not the masses,
mm-hmm.
it has to be the entire country
mm-hmm.
that needs to say, listen,
mm-hmm.
look at us, where are we going?
Mm-hmm.
We need to have a change of heart,
mm-hmm.
we need to start seeing country first.
Mm-hmm.
And once we stop that type of pattern, they know that with $1 million, with $5 million, they can go ahead and pay any group of Haitians,
mm-hmm.
and they will go ahead and start uprising to ask any president to go.
Mm-hmm.
It is time for us Haitians to start seeing country first,
mm-hmm.
seeing ourselves as a nation, to be united, and
mm-hmm.
then you'll start seeing changes in Haiti.
Okay.
As long as we're going to have those little groups here and little groups there,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's taking for themselves and not for the country,
mm-hmm.
we're not going to go anywhere.
I want to ask you, later this year, in October, officially the mandate of the minister is up for renewal at the UN. Should we, as solidarity activists in Canada and elsewhere, should we be pushing to make sure that the occupation stops? That the
We've been asking for the minister to leave Haiti, because to tell you the truth, they are not doing anything. I don't know if you've been to Haiti lately.
Yeah, well, not Haiti.
Most of the time, if you go on the beaches, that's where you find them.
That's what I heard.
If you go in the clubs at night, it's all them. It's not proper. It's not right.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to Gonaïve since the hurricane back in August,
mm-hmm.
in September,
mm-hmm.
nothing has changed very
mm-hmm.
much.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather, instead of seeing those guns, machine guns,
mm-hmm.
seeing tractors trying to rebuild the country, if they were there to do some good to the Haitian
mm-hmm.
population, it would have been more helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure once we set ourselves as a nation and stop doing the blaming game,
mm-hmm.
We need a new, as they would say in French, a nouveau départ.
Bien bonjour.
Bonjour.
And you are listening again to CKUT 90.3 FM, 4 hours of power, 5 years of resistance. You were just listening to activist Lucie Tondreau, an activist with the Haitian community in Miami. Before her, we had an interview with Patrick Elie, an activist in Port-au-Prince, talking about Cuban cooperation and how a cooperation between the countries of the region may be more constructive than this sort of top-down model where Canada or Western countries come and say how Haiti needs to develop itself. We are coming to the end of a very long show. Stephen and I are still hanging in here in the studio. Before we go to our final interview, we would like to give out a few thanks to everyone who's helped us with this program. We'd like to thank Tariq here at CKUT, also Courtney at CKUT, Gretchen also at the station, Annabelle. We'd like to thank some of the Haiti Action Montreal members, Diego, John McDonald, Nick, and Eve. If there are other people that helped us and we forgot, we are very, very sorry, but we're thankful for so many people coming together to help us with this this important show. This show is also, as I said, going to be broadcast later on CKDU in Halifax. So we'd like to thank the Dalhousie University Radio for also carrying this information, for help spreading the word. And we would like to thank Making Contact, a U.S.-based radio station with international, which is broadcast as an international syndicate. So we may speak again before the top of the hour, before we give way to the next show. But we'd like to thank everyone for being with us for these 4 hours, for remembering and caring about what happened in Haiti as an example of a Western country affecting regime change and imposing an economic model that the country in the South does not want. So if anyone is interested also in more information, we can go on to, they can go on to the website of the Canada Haiti Action Network. That's http://canadahaitiaction.ca. And if you'd like more information from us, you can contact the Haiti Action Montreal chapter by dialing 514-618-2253. 514-618-2253. We are going to move into our final interview, and this is an interview with union activist Lulu Chéri. This is a French language interview. Lulu was with us in Montreal in, I believe, the month of June or perhaps May, June of this year, talking about the situation of confronting neoliberalism from a worker's perspective in Haiti. So we've been talking for these last 4 hours about a coup, about a political, economic agenda that the rich countries are imposing on Haiti, and we want to give the last word to someone who's going to discuss how it feels to be on the receiving end of that, how it is to be a worker and a worker in struggle, and how workers still attempt to struggle and defend their lives in today's Haiti, 5 years after the coup. So the last word of this show goes to Lulu Chéri, and here is Lulu.
Votre ami l'a annoncé, mon nom c'est Paul Lulu Chéri. Alors je suis secrétaire général de la Confédération des travailleurs haïtiens, CTH, qui est très certainement la confédération syndicale la plus représentative dans le pays, et qui a une affiliation et sur le plan international à la CSA, qui est la Confédération syndicale des Amériques, et également affiliée sur le plan mondial à la CSI, qui est la Confédération syndicale internationale. Et Peter, finalement, et, que je considère plus qu'haïtien que les Haïtiens, qui, à mon avis, moi je vis tout ce qu'il vient de raconter là. Parce que j'étais en Haïti, quand il parle, comme si je vois ce qu'il dit. Et je comprends parfaitement et la façon avec laquelle il explique la situation, vraiment, c'est extraordinaire et c'est la situation. Mais arrivé en 2004, cette campagne, cette politique pour maintenir les Haïtiens dans cette situation de misère, de pauvreté et critique continue. Il a fallu continuer à faire des pressions, et pour cela, il fallait trouver quelqu'un pour mettre au pouvoir, pour continuer avec cette série de persécutions politiques de toutes sortes, pour prouver justement que le régime là, voilà, c'était mauvais, et il y avait un problème. Effectivement, voilà ce qui a été fait après le départ du président Aristide. On fait venir en Haïti quelqu'un qui a passé 40 ans en dehors du pays, la tortue pour être Premier ministre en Haïti. Et Boniface, comme a dit la Constitution, comme président de la Cour suprême ou de la Cour de cassation, et président, proclamé président, et on lui a forcé d'être accepter le choix pour être président de la République. Bon. À ce moment-là, c'était extrêmement grave pour nous, les Haïtiens, qui étaient au pays. On a connu toutes sortes de persécutions, sauf le petit groupe dont a parlé notre ami Peter, qui vivait tranquillement, qui avait tous les privilèges, tout marchait bien pour eux, mais la majorité de la population était terrorisée totalement par le pouvoir en place, et en plus avec l'occupation claire menée par d'abord ces trois pays qui ont organisé le coup d'État, ensuite par la présence de l'ONU en Haïti. Il a fallu un travail énorme pour que le peuple puisse pas accepter ce qui se passe, mais se résigner et commencer par oublier Aristide. On a tenté de faire des petites actions pour prouver que Aristide, il n'était pas bon, tout ça, mais ça n'a pas marché. Des campagnes de dénigrement, des campagnes de désinformation
l'ANMH, les patrons des médias haïtiens qui diffusent 99% les informations qui sortent d'Haïti sont totalement mensongères. Il n'y a pas de doute. Ce qui se passe en Haïti, on n'en parle plus. Alors, le peuple était pratiquement terrorisé, mais il a fallu 2 ans pour l'organisation des élections. C'est à ce moment-là qu'on va voir. Le peuple haïtien, c'est au-delà de tout ce qu'on pense, tout ce qu'on dit, moi je considère jusqu'à aujourd'hui, être un grand peuple. Wow. Il n'y en a pas aucun moyen d'imaginer, de penser que quelqu'un comme président, M. Préval, va être élu comme président de la République. Il n'y a aucun moyen, aucun moyen. Il y avait Kaplim, Becker, des campagnes extraordinaires, Maniga, etc. Tout le monde avait oublié s'il y avait quelqu'un qui pouvait... je ne sais pas comment dire ce mot-là. Alors, je me souviens de ce moment-là. On fait des campagnes pour empêcher, pour bloquer la participation de la population aux élections. On a placé des bureaux de vote à 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 kilomètres. Vous savez, Haïti, il n'y a pas de transport. Ça n'existe pas pratiquement, le transport en Haïti. Ça n'existe pas. Alors, je ne dis pas presque pas, mais ça n'existe pas à comparer à ce que moi, je vois, mon Dieu, ici au Canada, et en Europe, et aux États-Unis, le transport, ça n'existe pas. Il a fallu que le peuple marche à pied pour aller voter. Et il pensait que le peuple n'allait du tout au vote. Effectivement, à la veille, c'était le miracle. Même s'il n'y avait pas et une confiance placée au président Préval à 100%, mais parmi tous ceux qui étaient là au pays comme leader politique, etc., le peuple leur dit, je vais prendre ma chance avec Préval. Et le peuple est allé voter massivement. Ils ont élu Préval comme président. Malgré tout, on faisait le conseil électoral d'abord, a fait pas mal de manœuvres pour empêcher de voler les élections, et le peuple était obligé de se rendre à l'hôtel Montana pour aller se baigner, pour trouver un endroit, et c'est dans le luxe également, et finalement, on a finalement donné le pouvoir à président René Préval. Bon. Préval, président d'Haïti, est-ce que toute c'est la solution? Est-ce que maintenant, le peuple peut dire que ça va? Non, 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 non. Préval, vous êtes président, oui. Le peuple vous a élu comme président. Mais pour rester au pouvoir, il a fallu l'apport, le support ou l'accord des chefs, comme vous savez, la France, le Canada, les États-Unis. Sinon, le peuple ne peut pas maintenir le président Préval au pouvoir. Et comme vous pouvez constater, tout récemment, il y a eu une émeute. Le peuple sort dans la rue justement pour revendiquer quoi? De la nourriture. Parce qu'il n'y a pas moyen de survivre. Le coût de la vie, le pouvoir d'achat, ça n'existe pas. L'emploi, pratiquement, c'est un luxe en Haïti. Plus de 80% de la population ne travaille pas. C'est-à-dire, travaille, mais pour rien. S'il n'y a pas de travail, on ne peut même pas parler de salaire. Le salaire minimum, aujourd'hui, au moment où nous parlons, est fixé à combien, s'il vous plaît?
1,65$.
1$?
65, oui.
65, 67, 68, c'est-à-dire 70 gouttes par jour. Hein? On voit un président dans un pays qui, apparemment, on sent, n'a pas la capacité de réagir et d'agir par rapport aux problématiques de la population. Il y a des pressions qui sont en train d'exercer très certainement sur le président Préval et qu'il ne peut pas dévoiler, c'est clair. Par exemple, le Venezuela, Cuba, ce sont deux pays amis d'Haïti et qui nous aident de façon réelle. les Cubains envoient des médecins en Haïti dans les quartiers pauvres pour consulter, pour travailler avec la population. Et ça, c'est concret. Le Venezuela fait de même dans le cadre du programme des Pétro-Caribéens, c'est-à-dire un programme qui facilite, qui donne du carburant à Haïti, environ 14 000 barils de pétrole par jour. Mais il n'y a pas moyen même de baisser le coût du camion au niveau de la pompe. Il n'y a pas moyen. Parce que on ne veut pas que le président baisse. On ne veut pas que ça baisse. Même si l'objectif fondamental du président Chavez, c'est de contribuer à aider la population à plus ou moins respirer et baisser un peu le coût de la vie. Mais il y avait une grève organisé par les organisations de travail de transport. Quand le président Chavez a vu ça à la télévision, il a appelé en Haïti pour voir qu'est-ce qui se passe. Mais j'ai donné assez de carburant pour que cette situation ne se présente pas. Et puis la réponse était, il faut nous comprendre parce que on exerce des pressions sur le pays pour ne pas toucher à cette question-là. Voilà. Nous sommes là comme un peuple. Il y a des exigences des grandes puissances qui veulent que le pays reste tel comme il est. La population cherche à sortir de la situation. Parfois, ils prennent la rue, mais il n'y a pas de solution. Il n'y a pas de solution. Bon, c'est pour justement, très certainement, c'est sur la pression des grandes puissances pour qu'ils pour continuer à appliquer le plan néolibéral qui est totalement en contradiction avec la syndicalisation qui n'accepte pas du tout la question syndicale. Alors nous autres au niveau du mouvement syndical en Haïti, on peut imaginer la situation dans laquelle que nous évoluons. Il y a une tentative du président pour rencontrer le secteur syndical, essayer de travailler avec le secteur syndical. On a fait environ 7 rencontres avec le président de la République. Brusquement, c'est interrompu. C'est-à-dire, notre situation, personne ne peut pas imaginer qu'est-ce qui va se passer en Haïti de jour à l'autre. On met le pays dans une situation d'instabilité permanente. C'est pour justifier la présence de la force étrangère dans le pays. Des fois, ils incitent. Cette force, elle incite la violence. On fait du kidnapping. Mais c'est justement pour dire que Haïti est un pays de violence, un pays d'insécurité. Il n'y a pas moyen de faire de l'investissement là-dedans. Laissez tomber. Alors, la politique du président Aristide, la politique sociale, la politique pour essayer de sortir le pays dans cet marasme économique qu'il se trouvait, vous voyez, il y a tellement d'opposition. On utilise même les Haïtiens pour aider aux forces internationales de détruire le pays. Alors nous autres, en tant que mouvement de travailleurs, des fois, on se pose cette question, l'avenir de nos enfants, l'avenir de ce peuple qui a le droit de vivre comme tout autre peuple, est-ce que nous sommes condamnés à vivre dans cette situation de façon éternelle? Il y a tellement d'hypocrisie à travers des promesses fallacieuses que font les grands pays là. Si on entend parler un ambassadeur, soit ambassadeur canadien, ambassadeur américain ou ambassadeur de France, on peut dire, on pense que dans une semaine ou dans deux semaines, Haïti va être libéré, tout va marcher très très bien. Il faut tellement de promesses. Mais dans les faits, dans la réalité, il n'y a pratiquement pas grand-chose. On nous divise également. C'est comme si on accepte cet état de fait. On accepte, il y a de la résignation. Je crois qu'il faut quand même une autre forme de révolution dans ce pays-là pour qu'on trouve plusieurs autres Aristides qui, dans les jours à venir, qui vont prendre des décisions pour poser véritablement le problème, et la solution doit être une solution haïtienne. Je crois fondamentalement il faut continuer. Il faut continuer à nous appuyer, continuer à dénoncer cette situation, continuer à faire pression de résoudre notre problème à notre manière. Et sinon, ça va être toujours difficile. Et la force internationale qui est en Haïti est là au moins pour 25, 30 ans, on ne sait pas quoi. On dit, ils sont là pour 25 ans. La décision est au peuple haïtien. Merci beaucoup.
Donc, merci beaucoup, Loulou. Surtout, c'est quelqu'un qui est sur le terrain. Donc, je trouve que les nouvelles qu'il a données, c'est pas mal différent de ce qu'on voit à Radio-Canada et TVA, bien entendu. Donc, on va avoir une intervention d'une personne ici.
Moi, je suis Marie-Célie Agnan. Je voulais, profiter, prendre la parole pour rappeler l'importance que dès 1804, Haïti s'est retrouvé dans la mire des impérialistes après l'indépendance. Et de manière beaucoup moins évidente, sans doute qu'avec ce qui se passe avec Cuba aujourd'hui, où Cuba connaît 50 années de boycott. Mais c'est à peu près ce qui s'est passé avec Haïti depuis 1804. Tous les pays impérialistes se sont organisés en coalition pour éviter que ce pays jamais ne se développe. Et tout de suite après, c'est-à-dire j'ai pris cette initiative de... Parce que je trouve qu'on n'insiste pas assez souvent là-dessus. Ce boycott qui a eu depuis 1804 contre ce pays. Et tout de suite après, dans les années 1840, la France a imposé le paiement d'une... Moi, j'appelle ça une rançon. Haïti a dû payer au cours actuel, lorsqu'on a fait, des recherches, c'est une dette qui s'oppose, qui s'élève à... 90 milliards de dollars, je pense, au cours actuel. Haïti a dû payer rubis sur ongle aux anciens colonisateurs, hein, une somme qui aurait pu servir à développer le pays. Puis nous avons connu l'occupation américaine, qui, à mon avis, a été comme une manière de creuser la tombe de ce pays. Et nous ne sommes jamais sortis de cette tombe. Et l'impérialisme et le néocolonialisme aujourd'hui continuent à enfermer Haïti dans cette tombe. Alors, il est toujours important de rappeler que dès 1804, le sort d'Haïti était fixé pour avoir, en quelque sorte, sonné l'alarme contre l'esclavage. Les conséquences, insister sur les conséquences du coup d'État de 1991 sur le démantèlement du mouvement populaire, le démantèlement des organisations populaires haïtiennes. Les gens qu'ils n'ont pas pu tuer à la faveur de ce coup d'État, ils leur ont offert des visas pour quitter le pays. Et depuis lors, le coup d'État était fait pour ça, au fait, pour démanteler les organisations populaires, les organisations de femmes. Je prends la parole à titre d'une militante, de quelqu'un qui a toujours été impliquée dans, pas en Haïti, parce que je vis au Québec depuis très longtemps, mais qui n'a jamais quitté Haïti de manière viscérale. La troisième chose que je voulais rappeler, c'est le deuxième coup d'État contre Aristide. L'importance de rappeler ce qu'on appelle le caractère assassination, qu'ils n'ont pas arrêté de faire depuis l'arrivée d'Aristide sur le terrain politique, mais qui a été vraiment virulent à partir de ce second coup d'État, où on a vu toute la presse internationale se mobiliser contre un seul homme, Aristide. Et tout de suite après, on n'entendait plus parler de lui. On a vu la même chose avec le Nicaragua. Personne ne savait où se trouvait le Nicaragua. À partir du moment où les sandinistes ont pris le pouvoir, eh bien, on n'a entendu parler que du Nicaragua. Qui sait aujourd'hui ce qui se passe au Nicaragua, la misère infrahumaine dans laquelle ce peuple vit depuis qu'ils ont sorti les sandinistes du pouvoir et qu'ils les ont pratiquement annulés. La troisième chose que je voudrais souligner, la quatrième et la dernière, c'est l'absence aujourd'hui de cette communauté haïtienne qui est à Montréal. Vous savez qu'elle est très nombreuse. Et il y a plus... Moi, je suis toujours frustrée, vexée et triste aussi de voir l'absence des Haïtiens dans les manifestations qui les concernent eux-mêmes. Je ne peux pas, si je veux être intègre, ne pas souligner cette absence. Il y a quelques personnes qui sont ici. Ce sont les mêmes que l'on voit toujours partout. Ils sont vraiment très peu nombreux et je tiens à le mentionner. C'est un phénomène qui n'est pas nouveau. Pourquoi est-ce que ce n'est pas nouveau ? On peut l'attribuer à différentes choses. Lorsque nous sommes arrivés ici, en tant qu'immigrants, nous sommes arrivés avec une absence d'organisation. Parce que Duvalier, lorsqu'il est arrivé au pouvoir, la première chose qu'il a fait, c'était de défendre les syndicats, les organisations d'étudiants. Nous n'avons pas l'habitude de l'organisation. Et ce manque d'habitude nous poursuit jusqu'à aujourd'hui. Nous sommes aussi dans l'impossibilité d'avoir ce regard qui embrasse l'histoire pour voir que notre histoire, c'est aussi celle des Palestiniens qui luttent, d'aller beaucoup plus loin que le petit problème que nous avons, nous, en tant qu'Haïtiens. Tout cela pour vous dire que nous avons besoin de votre aide et que je vous remercie d'être ici aujourd'hui. Nous avons besoin de ce soutien. Alors voilà.
And those were some stirring final words on this special broadcast of Radio Résistance, 4 Hours of Power, 5 Years of Resistance, commemorating the fifth anniversary of the coup d'etat in Haiti, looking for the future, looking for solutions, looking for a strengthened solidarity between Montreal and Haiti, for activists, researchers, and people of good faith to come together and fight to bring the truth out on this matter, to fight structural adjustment and imperialism wherever it rears its head. We'll be coming back to you in the following months, definitely. We'll have the regular show at the end of March, last Thursday of the month. We'd like to thank you so much for being part of this program, for listening to all these 4 hours. You can obviously find this program on your website if you go to www.ckut.ca and go to Programming and Archives, looking on the Thursday program, starting with the off-the-hour slot. So I'd like to thank, again, everyone that contributed to this program, the CKUT staff. I'd like to thank you, Steve, for being with me in the studio. I'd like to thank Bianca, Nick, Eve, and the other folks from Haiti Solidarity, and, of course, to all the crew at the station, Courtney, Tariq, Gretchen, Annabelle, and various others. And so thank you very much. This has been 4 hours of explaining the coup d'etat and explaining how to fight against it. And we will continue to fight against it, and we will continue to build true solidarity.
Hoping that we open some new eyes too, you know.
Definitely.
And I just want to say the music we played, because I haven't had time to say which music we played. We played music from the Hands Off Haiti CD, mm-hmm. the Chan CD, and we played some MC Desalinien, you know, so all that, you know, that good music that was playing, that's what it was.
And we'll be going out with a song.
Capo L'Amour, aka MC Desalinien.
We'll be going out with a song, and we'll be back in March with more Hours of Power and more resistance. Thanks so much for listening. Peace.
Set ablaze by Bookman, 100,000 slaves and those unafraid who heard through the wire. You inspired Denmark, Bessie, and Nat Turner. Countless rebellions with machetes and burners. Maroons armed and they own farms with a village arm, chopping up arms of slave masters. And all sell out sounding alarms because they had to. Black Pearl, unfurl your flag of hope. Black Pearl, white fang still clutch your throat. Black Pearl, you inspired.
divide the world. Black pearl, you're still a black pearl to me. Eh, eh, bomba, kango, bafio te, kanga, mundele, kanga, doki, la, kanga, li, sapase, nambule, liberté, Haiti.
Sapase, saka, fe, tu muna, isye, saka, fe, nambule, 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 moche.
Liberté,
nous besoin liberté, mon pays, moi.
When voodoo ceremony initiating Haitian liberation, rushing waters out of balas, there's no taming. Drown the orchestrators of this coup against their nation. Through political isolation, economic asphyxiation, Aristide was destabilized, he wouldn't agree to privatization. That's when the US IMF him with sanctions, abandoned the places to the bicentennial celebration. The CIA organized landowners and merchants under Group 184 conversions, trained illegal soldiers, put the murders back into service.